This is Dr. David Stevens, your host on Christian Doctor's Digest. I just want to thank you for taking some time out of your busy schedule to focus on a couple issues that are really important in our culture. In fact, this issue is focused on the biblical-based form of marriage and love, and then we're going to contrast that with what's going on in the world. Between our two guests, we're going to start with Nancy Piercy, who's going to talk about her book, Love Thy Body. And this is a fabulous book that has lots of good information on what's going on in our country and how to approach it. And then we're going to move to biblical-based love and talk to Dr. Steve and Rita Manini, talking about our marriage enrichment weekends. How can we take biblical-based marriages and make them even better? And they've got some great insights and as well as sharing opportunities to do that. I'm really looking forward to these topics to really see that contrast and help educate us on these important issues. Let's get to Nancy Piercy. It's a pleasure to welcome Nancy Piercy to our microphone. She's been here once before talking about another one of her books, Total Truth, which I highly recommend. She's a Francis A. Schaeffer Scholar at the World Journalism Institute. She teaches worldview courses. She studied violin at Heidelberg Christian Worldview under Schaeffer in Switzerland, graduated from university with a distributed studies degree in philosophy, German, and music. She earned a master's from Covenant Seminary and did further graduate work at the Institute for Christian Studies in Toronto. She's a visiting scholar at a number of institutes, has written tons of articles in magazines, and has spoken widely. And the best news is she's going to be at our national meeting this coming spring, going to be one of our speakers as well. So you'll have the opportunity if you come to meet her personally. Let's talk about her latest book, Love Thy Body, one of the best I've read in a long time. Nancy, you've written a book with a provocative title, Love Thy Body. When I first saw that, I thought, what in the world is this about? Kind of give us the thesis of the book. What's the main stream that runs through it?
Well, the main stream is to help people understand where these issues are coming from that we're being barraged by in the media these days, from abortion and assisted suicide to homosexuality, transgenderism, and even the hookup culture. And my point is to help people recognize where these things are coming from. An awful lot of Christian books do exegesis. They tell you what the Bible says, and that's very important. But what we're not doing is giving people the tools to understand the secular mindset so that we can equip people to answer the questions that secular people are asking. And that's the goal of Love Thy Body. It's helping to show that the secular views do not have a high view of the body, that they actually disparage our biological identity, and that gives us an opportunity to take on these questions with a new message. Instead of coming out there and just saying, it's wrong, it's sinful, don't do it, which is where, you know, the stereotype is that Christians tend to be very negative and judgmental. And Love Thy Body gives them an opportunity to come out with a positive message that, no, it's Christianity that has a high value of the body, that gives dignity, value, and significance to the body. And the reason we're reaching out to people is not to judge them, but to help them and to love them and to help them to have a better, higher view of their own bodies, of their own self, since our body is an important part of our identity. If you devalue the body, you are devaluing an important part of a person's identity. We have a positive message for people.
You know, you talk about Francis Schaeffer's metaphor, the two-story building. Why don't you share that? Because it's kind of a thread throughout the book, helping to understand that really what's going on here is dualism, back to Gnostic times in some sense of the body and the self or the mind being separate.
That's right. Francis Schaeffer applied it primarily to the concept of truth. He was showing that the concept of truth has been divided, that people have always known that there's a natural order and there's a moral order. But people always thought they were united, that the natural order is integrated with the moral order, so that truth is one integrated system. But in the modern age, with the rise of modern science, many people decided that the only reliable knowledge is empirical facts. So what did that do for things like morality and theology? Well, they cannot be stuffed into a test tube or studied under a microscope. So many people decided, well, they're just not really truths at all. They're just personal opinion, personal belief, personal subjective preferences. And so the whole moral theological side of truth was, in a sense, cut off. I sometimes picture it as a tree. If it's hit by lightning, half the tree falls down. Hmm. Or Schaeffer's metaphor was two stories in a building. In the lowest story, we have the supposedly objective facts of science, empirical, rational, rationally knowable. In the upper story, we have the subjective, privatized views of morality and theology. That was the thesis of my book, Total Truth. Mm-hmm. I explained that fact-value split, as it's called. In this book, Love Thy Body, I show how even the view of the human person has been split in half, so that the body is considered separate from the mind or the emotions. And many of the moral issues today all rest on that divide, as you put it, as a kind of dualism. Let me start with abortion. That's what's easiest to see.
Sure.
In my book, I tell the story of a British broadcaster who said, I was always firmly pro-choice until I got pregnant with my own baby. And then I began to struggle. She's a broadcaster, so she even did a documentary on abortion. And at the end, she said, I've decided it's true, life begins at conception. But maybe life itself doesn't matter. What matters is when the baby starts to become a person. Well, if you can be human at one point, but not a person until sometime later, then obviously those are two different things. So what's happened to the human being here? It's been split in two. On the one hand, you can say that that biologically, scientifically, empirically, we know now that the baby is human from conception. But that doesn't matter. That does not give the fetus moral standing. It does not warrant legal protection. What matters is that it becomes a person, which is described as a certain level of self-awareness, cortical functioning, and so on. So it's this dualism that is the central argument today in arguments for abortion. The central argument is the fetus is human from conception, but at that point it's just a disposable piece of matter. It can be killed for any reason or no reason. It can be used for research, tinkered with genetically, harvested for organs, and disposed of with the other medical waste. So you can see how this is an outworking of the fact-value split. In a sense, you could say to be biologically human is a scientific fact in the lower story, but to be a person is an ethical concept in the upper story. So that's the dualism that is now at the heart of all of these moral issues.
And the issue is then if personhood is just a subjective decision made by whoever who decides what they're going to decide, what qualities make that up today? There's no scientific support for that. It's not empirical. And so it's just a matter of opinions and whoever has the power to make something happen.
That's exactly right. It's kind of ironic now that it's Christians who are standing on the side of science and facts, because you know the stereotype, of course, is that we are imposing our personal private beliefs on everyone else. But instead, think of it this way. If the fetus is just a piece of matter that can be known, you know, by scientific facts, and then at some point it becomes a person who has so much value that now it's a crime to kill it, that is a momentous change. That is a momentous transformation. Can it be detected empirically? No. There's no transformative point that science can detect objectively. So the definition of personhood is, as you say, private, subjective, arbitrary. In fact, if you read the literature, the line is drawn at a different place by every bioethicist. There's no agreement on when the fetus becomes a person. So it is Christians today who we should be turning the tables on this and insisting that we're the ones who stand for science and that the pro-abortion arguments now are the ones that are private, subjective, and personal.
Yeah. What about the issue of sexuality? You talk, have a whole chapter about the hookup culture and what this dualism, how it underlies that and helps us make sense of what's going on.
Yeah, that's so interesting because the dualism is what's really the connecting thread for all of these moral issues. The hookup culture has a very strict script, we could say. The rules of the game are no love, no relationship, no commitment. Well, some people might think that focusing on the physical like that gives sex too much importance. But in reality, it gives sex too little importance. There was a young man quoted in Rolling Stone magazine that said, "Sex is just one piece of body touching another piece of body. It is existentially meaningless." So what's happened there is that sex has now been treated as something that's just a product of, a body is just a product of blind material forces, that the human being is just a physical organism driven by sheer physical drives with no higher purpose, cut off from the whole person. That's the dualism. The human body is being treated as something that's just a mechanical tool that we can use for pleasure, we can use for recreation, but that's not really part of the whole person. In Love Thy Body, I quote some college students, and it's really quite poignant because they all say things like, well, with us these days, it's physical only. The personal is not part of it. And they'll say, for us these days, the connection is purely on the bodily level, and we have no personal connection with people whatsoever. It's very, very sad when you read the statements by college students, and many of them say privately that they're very disappointed with these meaningless sexual encounters, and they feel hurt and lonely, and they wish they knew how to create a genuine relationship. So this is really an example of where dualism is creating an internal fragmentation that is very painful and is tearing young people apart.
You know, and that's even coming through our sexual education that you see in secular situations. It's all how-tos and, you know, get permission and anything goes. How does that contrast with the biblical approach on sexuality? There's such a dramatic contrast there, as they are on all these issues we're talking about. Maybe this is a good place to dig into that one.
Well, yeah, I agree with you that sex education reinforces this view that universities hold sex weeks where porn stars are brought in and sex toy companies are invited to display their wares. I had an article in Fox News just a week ago. There was a new book out saying that it's kind of the post-Harvey Weinstein wave. And now there's revelations coming out on sexual exploitation all over the place. And this book is now on Silicon Valley, that Silicon Valley has a problem with sexual exploitation, and that the movers and shakers of the tech world, entrepreneurs, investors, founders of companies, are hosting drug-fueled sex parties. And you say, well, of course, look at where they're being trained. They're being trained in universities that hold sex weeks, and where young people are being pressured to imitate porn stars. And the pressure starts in high school when it's all how-to. It's all the mechanics of sex and the mechanics of how to avoid pregnancy and disease and so on. In fact, one study found that many young people in high school feel pressured to have sex based on their sex education classes. And it goes all the way down to fashion and a slut style for little girls, and even infant clothing that says, I'm too sexy for my diaper. Hmm. So children are being sexualized at ever younger ages. But where does it all come from? There was a fascinating quote in a New Yorker article recently, and it called it the loyalty oath of modernity. The loyalty oath that you're supposed to take if you're a modern person is, and here's a quote, nature is without conscious design. The emergence of Homo sapiens was without meaning or purpose. And that's where it all comes down to. People don't realize that the sexual ethic is coming from a notion that the universe has no purpose or meaning, and that means my body has no moral message. There's nothing about my body that tells me this is how I'm supposed to choose in terms of my moral choices. The biblical view is so positive and so humane and so affirming and so hopeful compared to that. It says the universe itself was created by a loving God to serve his purposes, and that our body also reflects God's purposes, and that we're not just on our own to figure out what's right or wrong. And we're not on our own to figure out just subjective meanings of, well, if this works for me, maybe it doesn't work for you. Instead, God himself has given us a guidebook to help us know how to live in line with our bodies, what our identity should be, what our moral guide should be. I think people often treat biblical morality as arbitrary. God just saying, thou shalt not. But in fact, since God created our bodies, he's giving us a guidebook on what it means to be truly human, how to live in line with the purpose he's given us so that we can be more fulfilled and we can have sexual relationships that have depth and significance.
Yeah, and we see that even in the studies that the most sexually satisfied group are middle-aged Christian adults that are faithful to their spouses. And that makes a huge, huge difference. And yet the world tries to paint it in a different way. You go on and talk about these other issues from euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide to homosexuality, transgender. What's one of the other topics we can get into? We don't have time to get in all of them, but which other one of these that you talk about would you like to get into before we close?
Well, probably the one that is the most prominent is homosexuality. Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about how it reveals that body-person dualism. No one really denies that biologically, physiologically, anatomically, males and females are counterparts to one another. That is clearly how the human sexual and reproductive system is designed. So when someone embraces a same-sex identity, implicitly they are contradicting that design. They are saying, well, why should the structure of my body inform my identity? Why should my body and my biological sex have any say in my moral choices? Well, this is a profoundly disrespectful view of the body. The implication is what counts is not whether I'm biologically male or female, but solely my mind, my feelings, my desires. So it's that upper-lower story divide again. The body's in the lower story, my feelings are in the upper story. And it has a fragmenting and self-alienating effect on the human personality. So those who defend a biblical view of sexuality are not relying just on a few scattered Bible verses of interest only to you if you're a literalist. What is really behind the biblical view is a teleological worldview. Teleology means purpose. So teleological worldview, where the structure of the universe, including the body, reflects the divine purpose. And as a result, the biblical ethic heals that self-alienation, and it leads to a holistic integration of personality. And that's the message we should be sending out to people, is that the secular worldview is fragmenting and alienating, and it's not about liberation. It is really the Christian worldview that liberates and gives people meaning and purpose and integration to their lives.
Really creates unity instead of this dualistic view, I am what I feel, which that goes into transgenderism and all the rest of it. That's my gender. I feel like that's my gender, so that's my gender, even though it denies the body.
Many readers of the book have gotten back to me saying, I picked up the book because I thought it would give me some handy answers to these current issues. Mm-hmm. But what I found is that it actually was challenging me. It challenges me to see how much I had absorbed this sacred secular split and how much I had not really appreciated the biblical teaching on the body. So I do help people get in touch with their own heritage. When Christianity started out, the early church faced the same thing we're facing today. They were surrounded by world-denying philosophies like Platonism and Gnosticism, which treated the world as a place of death, decay, and destruction. In fact, in Gnosticism, they taught that there were several levels of deity and that this world was created by a low-level deity that was evil, in fact, because no self-respecting God would get his hands dirty mucking about with matter. So in this context, Christianity was revolutionary. It taught that the highest God, the supreme deity, created the material world, and he pronounced it very good. An even greater scandal was the incarnation, that God himself entered the material world and took on a human body. So the incarnation is the ultimate affirmation of the dignity of the body. And finally, at the end of time, God is not going to scrap the material world as if he made a mistake. He's going to renew it and restore it, creating a new heaven and a new earth. So the Apostles' Creed affirms the resurrection of the body. This is an astonishingly high view of the physical world. There is nothing like it in any other religion or philosophy. So Love Thy Body gives people the tools not only to answer the secular worldview, but what I'm finding is that many readers say that they're discovering that Christianity is more appealing, more attractive, more compelling, more affirming, more humane than they ever realized, even though they were Christians.
You've got a wonderful study guide in this book. I was reading some of the questions as I'm preparing for this interview. I really want to encourage our members as we close this interview to not only get the book, but use it with medical students, use it with your colleagues in a Sunday school class or whatever, and help them really understand these issues, because it makes sense of issues that people are really struggling with and how to address and how to approach and how to do it lovingly and in a Christian manner, but at the same time, understanding what's going on. When you understand the motivation of what's doing this, it helps you find connect points to help people. And of course, we need to do that in our practice every day. Nancy, thank you for your great work. This is going to be very enduring, like your other books. And I think it makes a huge difference for people as they read it and understand the world that's going on around them.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate that.
I encourage you to get a copy of Nancy's book. If you're on the app, there's a button there that you can push, and it'll take you right to Life and Health Resources where you can order this book. If you're not, you can go on the web at cmda.org and to Life and Health Resources and order, or give us a call, 888-230-2637. Some of my fantastic staff will take care of you, and you'll have that book in your hands before you know it. And begin making plans to join us May 2nd through the 5th for the National Convention. Nancy's going to be there, I think, the whole weekend. She's doing workshops. She's doing a plenary. Be a great time to sit down and have dinner with her, something that's very difficult to do with most authors as famous as her. But you'll have the opportunity to develop a relationship and ask your questions. We'll be at Ridgecrest again, North Carolina. Come join us May 2nd through the 5th, 2019. You can register online. You know, usually I have Jeff Anderson here sitting across from me, but today we have our Vice President of Stewardship, Jamie Campbell. Jamie, what tax-wise topic do you have to share with us today?
I want to talk a little bit about donor-advised funds as a way to make charitable contributions.
For those who may not be familiar with them, can you explain the basics?
Just think of it as a charitable checking account, except you don't actually write the checks or keep up with the receipts. Here's how it works. You open a donor advised fund account and fund it with cash or appreciated securities or even non-cash assets like real estate or closely held business stock, and then you're able to, quote, advise the fund where to send the gifts on your behalf.
Oh, are there any tax benefits to using a donor advised fund?
Absolutely. We're always looking for maximum tax benefits. First is your income tax. You receive an immediate income tax deduction in the year you contribute to the Donor Advised Fund, or DAF. Since your DAF is a public charity, contributions immediately qualify for maximum income tax benefits. Capital gains tax. You incur no capital gains tax on the gifts of appreciated assets, securities, real estate, illiquid assets to your Donor Advised Fund. Estate tax. Your Donor Advised Fund is not subject to estate taxes. It grows tax-free. Your investments in the donor advised fund grow. You can invest them, and then you have more money to give away. And if you're in the situation where you're having to face an alternative minimum tax, a contribution to a donor advised fund can almost certainly reduce that impact.
You know, I opened my donor advised fund last year because I knew that the standard deduction was going up this year.
Right.
So I put in a larger chunk. Gave some of it last year and will continue to give it. And then every couple of years, I'll get above that minimum amount and put in another large chunk. So actually get some increased deductions of appreciated assets taken from an investment fund.
Well, that's the beauty of it. You can fund it just like you did. And we hear from other people who are doing that, who may have fixed incomes in retirement and that kind of thing. And they can't give enough away in 1 year to get the full deduction benefit. But you can fund it and let it sit for a year and then dole it out over the next couple of years if you want.
So now that I have donated to my donor advised fund, what would be some ways that I could use it?
Dave, you can use your donor advised fund to make gifts to really anywhere you normally would, just writing a personal check. You can make gifts to your church, your favorite Christian ministries, gift to private schools, not tuition, but gifts, your alma mater. Those kinds of things, even things like museums or other local nonprofit organizations, basically any 501c3 can receive funds from a donor advised fund. Each fund has some parameters, so you'll want to check that out before you get into it, but it's pretty straightforward. Interestingly enough, one of the benefits we hear from a number of our members and friends is the ability to give anonymously. Unless you're giving cash in unmarked envelopes, which we do not recommend, by the way, it's really about the only way to remain truly anonymous.
What about your family? I think all of us want to teach our children to be involved in giving. How do you use a donor advised fund in that way?
It's a great tool, Dave. You can be as creative as you want to be and get your family involved. You can pass your donor advised fund on to your children, so they can be part of that even beyond your lifetime. You can teach them the importance of supporting the things that are important to you, important to them. Hopefully, you'll find yourself not just passing along your valuables to your children, but more importantly, your values.
Yeah, great point. Okay, someone's sold on this idea. They've heard us talk about it. How do they get started?
A quick web search will turn up any number of companies that offer donor-advised funds, all the large brokerages you're familiar with, Fidelity, Schwab, Vanguard, any number of those have donor-advised funds. Many of our members, though, have intentionally decided to use organizations like the National Christian Foundation because they know they're working with people who share their faith and values and won't allow donations to go to places that really are not friendly to the gospel of Jesus Christ. And there's other good Christian donor advised fund providers out there as well. If you want to contact us here in the stewardship office at CMDA, we're happy to talk through the advantages of using a donor advised fund for your giving and which one might really work best for you.
So what's the best way to do that? How can people get a hold of us?
It's really simple. Just give us a call on our toll-free number at 888-230-2637 or by email at stewardship@cmda.org.
Jamie, thanks for this great information.
Thanks, Dave.
It's a pleasure to introduce to you Dr. Stephen and Rita Manini. They've been married for 38 years. They were high school sweethearts, have two grown children and two, as they say, precious little granddaughters. I don't know of any other type. Stephen is a semi-retired pulmonologist, most recently began serving patients in a wound care center, and helped start and continues to be the medical director of Heart Mountain Volunteer Medical Clinic in Cody. Serves as an elder at their church and is a group leader in Bible study fellowship. Rita recently retired as the executive director of a life-affirming pregnancy medical clinic, which she also helped start, continues to serve on their board, leads Bible study, is a mentor to young women. They've both been very involved in CMDA on GHO trips. Stephen's been a part of the House of Representatives, and for a number of years have been involved in the CMDA's Marriage Enrichment Commission, which they are now the chairs of. And that's what I wanted to get them here to the microphone for, to update you on how you can enrich your marriage and the impact this commission is having on couples' lives. Steve and Rita, I want to get caught up on the impact of the marriage commission and how it's impacting people's lives. You guys have been involved in this for a lot of years. Let's start with there. How did you guys get involved?
We were empty nesters when I don't remember if Steve had got the card in the mail or if I saw it on his desk. But anyway, we thought it would be a good thing to go and do, being empty nesters. We were just kind of looking at each other like, who are you after so many years of hard work and independent lives? Steve being the physician and me being mostly the stay-at-home mom raising a family. And we just found a lot of value in the weekend. We thought we had a great marriage going into it. But, you know, we always have issues and looking for ways to handle things better and to grow in our marriage. And we found it to be very beneficial to go. Came home with some really practical things we could do that we still go back and do some of these things, remind ourselves often of some of these practical steps that we can take.
You know, we call it a marriage enrichment. And I think sometimes people think a marriage weekend is for people that are having huge problems in their marriage or in a crisis or that type of thing. But this is really focused on making your marriage even better. And there's no ceiling to that, I don't think.
You're correct. Everybody should know, you know, marriage is hard work. And everything that the weekend covers is from a biblical perspective. And all of us can use a marriage tune-up, so to speak, just like your automobile needs a tune-up. And so coming and just investing the time to rekindle and refocus on the spouse that you married X number of years ago, it is so easy, as you know, that this profession can just suck the life out of you. And before you know it, you've lost track of the person that you said I do. And this, the weekends are just great because we have seen so many people arrive, for instance, on a Friday night, and the air between the couples that have been married 10, 20, 30, 40 years is so thick you could cut it with a knife. But after just relaxing and spending the time with their spouse and going through all the five sessions that we do over the weekend, by Sunday afternoon, they look like teenagers again, so to speak. I mean, it's almost disgusting, you know, see, because they're just huggy and kissy and, you know, and they're praying together. And gosh, it just brings tears to our eyes to see the transformation that it can occur in just 36 to 40 hours.
Yeah. We had a beautiful picture this last session of a couple that came in, and the husband's comment was at the end of the weekend that he didn't consider his long hours and his fatigue to be depriving his wife. And the wife very much felt like she was being deprived of him and of his attention and his focus. And we have a prayer session at the end of the weekend where they're knee to knee praying for each other. And it was just precious because they're cheek to cheek, looking into each other's eyes and praying for each other. And it just brought tears to our eyes to see that transformation happen over the weekend.
See how God's working in these lives. It's miraculous.
Well, I know a lot of prayer goes in for those weekends before you ever do get together. And this is why you and the others that are running this ministry and involved in it are involved, because it's a transformative ministry that prepares people not only to draw their marriages closer together, but to really be able to do the ministry God's called them to with their families, their communities, and their practices, you know, with a strong marriage as the foundation.
Yes, and one of the sessions actually we talk about is seeing how not only can these weekends draw you closer to your spouse, but also how both of you can be drawn closer to God. The what I call God-designed marriage. You know, have a holy, God-designed marriage, and to remind ourselves that our marriages are ordained by God, and that we want marriages that are led by His Holy Spirit.
Tell me what a weekend is like. You talked about five sessions. What are they?
Well, usually people, the couples will arrive Friday evening, and generally they're just worn out. And so the session number one from 7 o'clock to 9 o'clock, refocus biblically. And all these sessions are from a biblical perspective. And Friday night, we talk about how to balance your priorities. I don't have to tell you, the physicians are just extremely busy. During the day, on Saturday morning, we refocus on just looking at the personalities of each of us from a marriage and doctor's standpoint. In the afternoon, we really go through something that most couples really enjoy the most of the weekend, called communication and management of conflict. And we discuss something called how to take it to the cross. Then in the afternoon, we talk about marital romance and intimacy. Then they have the afternoon and evening off. And Sunday morning, we regroup for praise and worship and just recommitting our marriage to God. And then we end up just praying with each other. And that, by that time, the couple's hearts are just so transparent again. And they're just holding hands and crying with each other and praying with each other. And they just leave totally different than they did when they arrived Friday evening.
You know, the other thing I like about these marriage weekends, you have them in some really nice places. It's a romantic weekend away just by where you are, as well as the time you spend focusing in on your marriage. Tell us about some of the places that they're coming up in the weeks and months ahead.
We're scheduled for October in Bristol. This will be our first time there, and that beautiful setting there in the fall. With the leaves changing, it's going to be gorgeous. And we've been to, the one that we went to initially was in California in the Napa Valley. And that was just a beautiful weekend for us. We had beautiful weather and we were able to attend the conference. And we try to end on Saturday afternoon by 3 o'clock and then release the couples to go take a hike, take a walk, do whatever, and have a nice romantic dinner together in the evening. And then, of course, coming back on Sunday.
Last October, we were in Florida,
right?
And that was a very nice venue. And we try to, you're correct, we try to balance east and west sides of the country and have destination spots. And we also try to make it affordable for not just the established dentists and physicians, but also residents. And we have some scholarship money, too, available for that to help resident couples attend these marriage enrichment weekends.
You know, I know from experience that often it's the guys that are dragging their feet to go do a weekend like this, and being open and transparent with their spouse. And I want to challenge them to do it, because it's probably one of the most important things you can do to show love to your spouse and to build your marriage stronger. And that should be one of your primary goals, because it's going to impact you and your kids and your whole extended family. So take that challenge and go spend a weekend doing this. Tell me one more story before we close about somebody's life, that a couple that was impacted through a marriage enrichment weekend.
The ages really vary. We've had just recently the one couple that came, they've only been married a year and a half. So their experience was, they were an inspiration for the rest of us, because they were so lovey-dovey and hadn't had a lot of the issues and stressors that some of those who have been married longer have had. But they're willing to come and just looking for some guidance and some help early on, which I really wish we would have done in looking back. So many of the couples, every conference we've done, the majority are so stressed, come in, there is so many burdens on their marriage, on their lives. And like Steve said, we see that transformation from Friday night, the tension that they're coming in with on Friday night, and how God just takes that. And just by allowing them to come and be away from home, be away from the practice, away from their children, and just really focusing on God and each other. And we just really see some amazing changes by Sunday morning.
And sometimes, too, it is the younger. It seems like the couples that have not been married really very long, 5 years or under, and they're still in residency or dental school, but they're just being bombarded by all the negativity of this world in regards to marriage. And they come in with some different type of baggage that perhaps our generation, Rita and I have been married 38 years now, and we dated 6 years before that. So we've been together for 45 years, and there's just the different stressors of the last 5 to 10 years that is affecting the younger generations that the older aren't.
That's true. And many of them don't have good role models when they were growing up of a good marriage as well. And you look back on your own life and those who've had that kind of role models, what a blessing that have been. But for those that didn't, there's great information out there and habits that they can have, which can make a huge difference. I want to thank you for what you're doing and what the whole commission is doing. This is all run by CMDA members who are volunteering to do this and have a passion for it and do it so well. And I want to encourage those listening to go to cmda.org and go to the Marriage Weekend part of the website and look and see when it'd be a great time for you to get away and spend some time with your spouse on what's really very important, your marriage, which affects your kids, affects your community, affects your practice. If you aren't happy at home, things aren't going to be going well anywhere else either. So sooner or later, that problem will bear fruit that you don't want. So take time to make your marriage better. And thank you, Rita and Steve, for all you're doing. I'm just thrilled that we have this to offer as a service to our members.
Thank you. We appreciate the time with you too, and to be able to just inform people that we are passionate about Christ-centered and God-focused marriages.
I'd love to welcome you here to CMDA's headquarters on October 12th through the 14th for a Marriage Enrichment Weekend. It's going to be a gorgeous time of year. The leaves will be changing. You'll be in the meeting room where you'll be looking out towards the mountains with the walls just almost completely windows. It's just a beautiful sight to get away and enrich your marriage. Take time to do the important things. And one of them is to make your marriage even better. Hope to see you there. You know, I'm just thinking I'm a lot like you. Too busy, too much going on, bouncing from one thing to the next. It seems like you just don't have time hardly to breathe in the midst of a busy day. And I know that's true for many of you in practice. And even some of you that are retired that are listening to this, you get so busy in retirement, you hardly have time to think. And yet, it's so important, and that's what I want Christian Doctors Digest to be, to just kind of pull back and pause and look at some important issues. And that's what we've tried to do in this issue. And I want to encourage you to take this information, go to a Marriage Enrichment Weekend, or go and pick up Nancy's book and take the time to read it. Put it by your bed, read a chapter a night, and work your way through that book. And as you do that, I think the key in all these situations is then do something to apply it. And that's what I have to remind myself of, that I get so busy doing good things that I can forget the most important things. And then I can get information and not use it, and before long it's gone, and use it to help touch somebody's life. I've used some of the comments that Nancy made in her book and some of the insights I got as I've done media interviews, as I've talked to individuals, as I've related on some of these important topics that people are struggling with. I've talked to them about them with people at church, and using what God has given me gives me a responsibility to not just contain it, but to pour that life-living information, that water out into other people's lives and help them to grow and understand issues and be able to be voices of righteousness into our culture. So that's kind of my challenge to you. It's not profound, but it is important. And that is, continue to fill up so you can pour out. And if you pour out all day, like all of us do in healthcare, you can one day just realize the jug's dry. And you have to be taking in and strengthening your mind, strengthening your spirit, growing your faith. And then you'll overflow naturally into other people's lives. But if you're dry, that's not going to happen. So take some time, fill up the jug, and you'll pour out. Well, till we get a chance to get together again, thanks for joining us. We're here to serve you. Give us a call if we can help. All our staff stand ready to serve you. We work for you. And may God bless you as you continue to serve Him.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.